Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of Teaching Matters for the new season. You know, I get a lot of pitches for people to come onto the podcast, and the pitch that I got for this particular guest today just fascinated me because it's not typical of what we would normally talk about on Teaching Matters. But when you learn more about what my guest has to talk about, you'll immediately see the relevance, especially given the timing of the start to school. We know that more than 54 million students approximately are heading back to school this fall. Families are preparing to spend close to over $1,000 on supplies for many of those students, just getting them into the front door of the classroom at the start of the school year. Those rising costs make cheap online deals particularly tempting, but some of those bargains come with hidden risks. Fake school supplies and electronics can be poorly made. They can contain hazardous materials. They can malfunction unexpectedly and even expose families' personal information to cyber criminals. Last fiscal year alone, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection seized more than $7.3 billion worth of counterfeit goods nationwide, not all of those being school supplies, but still, that was a chunk of that. We will be discussing why this topic is important for all of us to understand on today's Teaching Matters podcast.
Welcome to the Teaching Matters podcast, where we discuss all topics related to teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, in collaboration with the Barbara Gerilds Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact at Ohio University. Here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Professor of Instructional Communication in Ohio University's Scripps College of Communication.
Thank you so much, Trinity. Today we have as our guest Frank Cullen. He's the Executive Director for the Council for Innovation Promotion, C4IP for short, a bipartisan nonprofit focused on intellectual property policy. Before coming to Washington's IP world, Frank ran communications for Sonny Bono's congressional office and later served 15 years on the Hill as Chief of Staff for Representative Mary Bono. An unusual path that also led through Francis Ford Coppola's Zoetrope Studios. He joins us today to talk about how he found his way into this work, why counterfeit goods are surging in the back-to-school season, and why the Shop Safe Act would be a particularly good thing to happen to protect people. Frank, it's great to meet you. Thank you for being on the podcast today.
Well, Scott, great to meet you as well, and thanks for the opportunity to be on your show. Really appreciate the opportunity to share some of our thoughts with your guests.
Absolutely. Let's start just so the audience members can learn a little bit more about you. You've spent time in entertainment communication as well as political communication, so you have a pretty diverse background, but can you connect the dots of how you started in the LA world, ended up in the Washington world, now in a nonprofit?
Try to keep it somewhat brief and not bore your audience. I grew up in a political family in California, was around politics my whole life, so I understood it. But I really wanted to be in the entertainment industry. I went to USC and graduated from their cinema and television school and wound up working for Francis Ford Coppola at his Zoetrope Studios in Los Angeles. It was a great time, really enjoyed it. But unfortunately, he was a far better director than a businessman. His studio closed. I chose to do some work that would pay me a little bit better at the time than some of the independent productions I had a chance to work on. That turned out to be a move that was, I'd characterize, a little bit of an unexpected turn, and wound up doing that for more years than I should have. Never got back to the entertainment industry except working with Sonny Bono a bit. And Sonny, of course, was an entertainer who became the mayor of Palm Springs. He needed someone who could help get his vision moved forward, and he hired me as a public relations director, but he also wanted to move forward in politics. Knowing that I had a background and understanding of that as well, we bonded pretty quickly, became great friends. I helped him establish himself as a credible politician, ultimately get to Washington. When he went to Washington, he asked me to come with him. I told him I'll do it no more than 5 years, but he unfortunately tragically died 3 years in, and I stayed on because I was very close to his family and wanted to make sure that his widow, Mary, was well supported when she took the seat. And the rest is, as they say, history.
So you're 15 years on the Hill, rising up to a chief of staff position with her. How does that shape your interest in public policy surrounding intellectual property right now?
Well, I always understood the importance of intellectual property because I grew up in a community of creators and folks in the entertainment business who relied heavily on copyright, which is one of the prime intellectual property policies that creators, of course, have to utilize to get those incredibly creative works to market. It was something that I knew was important. It was reinforced with my relationship with Sonny, who was, of course, a songwriter and had many copyrights, very successful ones. And it was really something that was impressed upon me even more through my time on the Hill when I intersected with many innovative companies that are some of the largest companies in America and how they relied on a variety of different types of intellectual property policies, whether they were copyrights, trademarks, patents, even trade secrets. They all played a role in the success and the economic growth of our nation's economy, a lot of domestic job creation and very well-paying jobs. So it was really apparent early on to me, both when I worked in the entertainment industry and later when I was on the Hill, that this was an important policy space that's often overlooked and sometimes people are not really aware of the huge economic impact it has.
And counterfeiting specifically, which we'll be, you know, delving into in more detail, that's not the only thing that your organization focuses on, but it sounds like it's a big part of it. Why is that particularly a problem?
Well, we, of course, focus on all aspects of intellectual property policy. We believe they drive our innovation economy and our creative output, which is responsible for a huge chunk of our economic growth. Approximately 40% of our economy depends, our GDP depends on the, you know, intellectual property related sectors. In addition to that, it's a great place to see new products and innovations brought to consumers. So it improves quality of life. But when you have people who are willing to copy that creative work or that innovation or invention, you put not only lives at risk, literally, but you also put our economic well-being at risk. So we understood that there was a place for us to try to get policymakers to have a clearer understanding of the importance of making sure that we had robust intellectual property enforcement against counterfeiters. Because at the end of the day, the victim here, many people think of it as a victimless crime, is far more than the person, the consumer, who just gets ripped off. It's our whole global economy. I don't know that people would even imagine how much counterfeiting, you know, is out there, but this is a huge, huge problem, approximately $500 billion a year globally, $200 million just here in the United States. So you can see this is very consequential for the companies that we work with and also the individual inventors, the startup, the individual songwriters and creators. It's a huge problem, and it's one that also really threatens the health and safety of American consumers.
You've done an outstanding job of, you know, talking about the big picture of this. Let's focus now in on why this is so relevant at this point in time. So I started the podcast by talking about, you know, the massive numbers of students starting school right now, but, you know, over the next several weeks, pretty much all of them will be, the massive amount of investment that families put into getting ready for school. Why does that sort of episodic moment create an opportunity for counterfeiters to sort of feed on that and put people at risk?
Well, you know, criminals are very clever. For decades and, you know, as long as most people were aware of the threat of counterfeiting or paid enough attention to it, that they started to try to categorize how much damage it did, you know, what type of counterfeiting occurred. It was really focused much more around the holidays and major mm-hmm. sporting events where folks would want to get a counterfeit jersey or some kind of memorabilia. So the holidays and these big sporting events like the Super Bowl were really when you saw the most activity in counterfeiting. But as you mentioned earlier in your introduction, the criminals are not going to stop just trying to sell a counterfeit during Christmas or during, the Super Bowl time. They're going to go out there and try to figure new ways to rip consumers off. And one of those areas they saw that was ripe for the picking was the back-to-school market. And the reason for that is all the things you've talked about. You know, families are trying hard to make sure their kids are prepared for the school year. We talked about the 54 million students. Those are only in K-12. We're not even talking about secondary schools, you know, people who are going to college, trade schools, that they might have to buy supplies for. There's a whole additional audience of individuals who probably have no idea that they might be exposed to criminal elements trying to rip them off. Counterfeiting comes in every size, shape, and possible product you can imagine. And certainly some of the things you mentioned have real health and safety concerns. It's not just the exploding battery that might be in a laptop or something that's made so poorly that it might create some kind of a risk for a young child, maybe a choking risk or exposure to lead. But it might also be something as simple as wearing a sporting jersey of their favorite team to school on that first day, only to find out it was made with dangerous dyes, fabric that can somehow irritate the skin or create real skin reactions, or other hazardous elements contained in the production of that item. So it's more than just getting a piece of junk, a piece of, substandard product. It's also that health and safety risk.
So you actually anticipated what my next question was, the examples of how it could pose risk. One other aspect of this that I found really interesting when going through your organization's website and several of the writings that you have is that there's also a cyber risk, because so many of these products now, as we all know, are bought online. And what are the risks to families when, you know, they find what they think is a great deal, they purchase it online, they're turning over their information? What are the risks associated with that?
Well, according to the Michigan State University, they did a study on this. 7 in 10 consumers are likely buying counterfeit products online just in the past year. And the reason that this happens, and it's such a prevalent issue, is consumer product shopping has changed. People are no longer going to stores in the same numbers, having the chance to inspect a product, actually physically. They have to rely on the online shopping experience to trust the vendor they are dealing with. And that puts them at risk, because very often, as you can imagine, everyone wants to get the best deal possible. We can all relate to that. We can all understand. You know, back in the day when counterfeiting was, you know, on the street corner or in flea markets or done in physical stores, you know, they might have a wildly discounted product, and most people kind of understood, okay, that's probably not legit, or maybe it's hot. You know, we don't know what it is. But if you're buying a Rolex for $25, you kind of know you're not getting a Rolex. But part of the problem here is that online, it's much harder to spot the fakes. And counterfeiters, as I said, have gotten very clever. They're not going to now offer a $25 Rolex, but they might offer a Rolex at 25% off, so the consumer thinks they're getting a great deal. And they'll create fake websites that look legit, where they rip and paste different images or even things that look to be secure, theft prevention type, links that you can click on or you can go to try to protect yourself, when in fact they're just creating a gateway to rip you off. So first of all, you want to go to a safe site. You don't want to click on links that you're not familiar with. You don't want to be deceived by counterfeiters who are doing everything they can just to make sure that they can peddle the product to you, and you're going to think you're getting a deal when in fact you're getting probably pretty much junk.
So let me ask a follow-up question on this. I totally understand your point of, okay, I need to find a set of crayons for Sally, and I go online, I do a Google search, I find something, I click on it, and I get to some weird website. That maybe would already ring a bell. Does that same risk exist if I go through one of the, not to name any names, but one of the large retailer online sites, where I could go into that particular site, do the search for the crayons? Do I still have risk of finding what could be potentially dangerous counterfeit, materials on one of those large retail sites online?
Yeah, absolutely, Scott. And it's a great question. You know, most people do believe when they go to an Amazon or an eBay or some of the other sites that they're dealing with a reputable company that's going to protect them from counterfeiters. And let's be honest, Amazon tries to do a good job of checking its site to prevent consumers from being exposed to counterfeits. But candidly, counterfeits can find their way into many different supply chains, even legitimate ones, even brick and mortar stores. This is not solely an online problem. But one of the other problems you have, particularly with sites that allow third-party sellers, is you can't check everything. You can't police everything in advance. And just going back to your previous point, you might be able to spot a fake website or a website that's selling counterfeits, but you might not. They become very sophisticated. And as I said before, very often they look like the real deal. So it's very important that people check when they click onto those sites, check the web address, check to see whether or not there's anything that looks a little bit off. Are the images not quite as vibrant or consistent as images you've seen on other sites, like the actual product site from the manufacturer? Or are there misspellings, or are there weird, uses of grammar that seem unusual, indicating it might be a foreign criminal organization that's put up some kind of a site to try to mimic what a legit site would be? But getting back to your point about the trusted platforms, the most trusted platforms are those that are actually provided by the vendor or a company you've done business with consistently over the years. When you go to an Amazon, when you go to an eBay, when you go to a variety of different sites, what you're going to find is, particularly when it comes to third-party sellers, it's much more difficult to verify what happens through their supply chain, and there will be risk for the consumer. And they will try to purge their sites of counterfeit goods to the extent they're able to do so. But the amount of counterfeit goods flooding the marketplace would stagger most consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. So just to sort of wrap this line of discussion up, let me ask this. It's a similar question to what you just asked. Let me ask it in a different way, though. If you had a child and you were getting ready for school right now and you got your list from the teacher that you needed to find stuff, what would the strategy that you personally would use to start trying to find a good deal that you have confidence that you're being as safe as possible?
People are going to shop online, so I'm not going to try to dissuade people from doing that. It's always good to be able to check something physically, but I think you first thing is that old axiom, trust your gut. If the price seems too good to be true, it's very likely it is too good to be true. So if something seems like it's wildly different than what you expect to pay for something, trust your gut and do a little bit more research before clicking on buy. The other thing is, make sure to verify who you're dealing with. Try not to buy from unauthorized third parties, if possible, but rather from the actual brands themselves. That gives you at least some degree of insulation from the counterfeiters or the fake sites. As I mentioned before, really pay attention to those websites you are on. If you're going to other websites than the actual brand site, make sure you're checking for all the various pieces. One of the things I mentioned before, sometimes there will be, symbols that will indicate that they have different types of consumer protection elements within their website. Very often, if you click on those, they'll take you to some kind of a site that might steal your information, or sometimes they're just pasted in there and they don't do anything. So make sure when you're dealing with a website, you have complete confidence that it's a legit website. Also, I mentioned the spelling mistakes and things. You really need to be careful when you're dealing in the online environment. And last thing is, once you get your product, if you've purchased it from any website, make sure you check it closely. Make sure that you look to see that it's up to snuff and it's what you expected to get. If you're buying a jersey for your kid, make sure the color matches what you really know the color of the team is. Make sure the stitching is proper. Make sure that the spelling on the on the washing instructions does not have, misspelled words or grammar that doesn't make sense. Look for certification marks, the certificate marks and trademarks that demonstrate that the product is authentic. These are all things consumers need to do to protect themselves. Don't just buy something and assume that because you bought it on a legitimate site, even, it's not potentially a counterfeit. Do your homework and make sure you're doing business with trusted sources.
One of the policy positions that your organization advocates for is the Shop Safe Act. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about what that act is trying to accomplish?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Congress has started to pay more attention to the threat of counterfeiting, and also through the proliferation of online purchasing, how they need to protect consumers. One of the things they have seen is that It's not easy to spot a counterfeit on a platform like Amazon, particularly with a third-party seller. It's not easy just to be able to have the consumer protected from purchasing that counterfeit. So the ShopSafe Act is really a step toward making online shopping safer, providing consumers and brand owners a little bit more protection from counterfeit goods. So in the online shopping environment, there's probably been, you know, tens of thousands of percent increase in terms of what counterfeits enter that online marketplace. And that's the broad online marketplace, not just one platform. So Congress paid attention and a bill was drafted called Stopping Harmful Offers on Platforms by Screening Against Fakes in E-commerce. Short title, ShopSafe. And the purpose of this bill is to really work to hold online platforms more accountable. What we've seen is that online platforms are not as likely to clean up their marketplaces. The ShopSafe Act would help reduce counterfeit sales in two key ways. It would make e-commerce platforms liable for counterfeit products sold on their sites unless that platform properly vets sellers and the product in their supply chain, and also establish best practices for preventing these types of sales. In addition to that, it would require that they establish points of contact between e-commerce platform and brands to help reduce the counterfeit products, because the brands often know who these counterfeiters are. Brands spend a lot of money with anti-counterfeit divisions going out and really looking into who the counterfeiters may be, what products they're putting into the marketplace, and how to spot them. So creating that type of mandate that there be established points of commerce between the e-commerce platforms and brands will help reduce more counterfeits coming into the supply chain. There is bicameral and bipartisan support for the ShopSafe Act, but it has not yet become law. So we would encourage every constituent to let their members of Congress know that they're concerned about the threat to their families and the threat to their pocketbooks and the threat to our overall economy that comes from supporting criminal enterprises that peddle counterfeits.
The last question I have for you, and by the way, we have a thunderstorm moving through. I'm not going to do up-to-date weather forecasts, but if you hear thunder, that's what it is. So if I'm a parent and I, you know, take the advice that you had of inspecting what it was that I got for my child, et cetera, and I conclude that it's not safe or that what I got is very likely a counterfeit. I've seen the misspelling on the label, et cetera. Is there anything that I could do in terms of recourse for that currently, or do I just throw it away and say, you know, I learned my lesson?
Well, first of all, hopefully folks will learn the lesson that they need to be more cautious and also not support these criminal enterprises. These criminal enterprises often support everything from other types of illegal activity, as you've referenced, the theft of personal information, financial information, family information, but they also support terrorism. And there are many documented cases of counterfeiting being used to support terrorism. So yes, people need to actually do something about this. Don't just say, well, I got duped, you know, bad move by me. I'm sorry that happened. I'll try to be more careful next time. Report it. Many, particularly in larger cities, many police departments actually have divisions that are devoted to this type of enforcement, enforcement against counterfeiters. And the amount of counterfeit enforcement that's occurring has increased greatly over the last couple of decades. At the federal level, there, and some states actually have departments that work on this as well. But at the federal level, this is handled mostly through the Department of Homeland Security, but also the FBI. There's a group called the National IPR Center, National Intellectual Property Rights Center, which brings together law enforcement from literally around the world, but also throughout America, to try to fight the issue of counterfeiting. They have a way to report through their website, the IPR Center website, if you think you've been duped. But don't let it just be a crime that you pass off as a mistake you made while shopping. Recognize it's a serious crime often done by large international criminal enterprises or gangs, sometimes local gangs here domestically. But It is a crime that needs to be reported. It's a crime that needs to hopefully be stopped before it grows more, which we know, of course, probably going to continue to grow. But unless people take it seriously, report it to their local authorities and also to the Department of Homeland Security, which has an entire division, the HSI, Homeland Security Investigation, that looks into these kind of issues, because the impact to our economy is staggering. And it's not just the economic loss. We also lose hundreds of thousands of jobs. Piracy costs companies over 750,000 jobs, and U.S. businesses, as I said earlier, over $200 billion annually. The reason for this is that when you have a counterfeiter taking market share away from a company, they're just not going to produce as much because obviously their market's been impacted. And the last thing I would say, you know, about the issue of this economic impact is we love the brands we love. And if you keep buying counterfeits and you get a pretty shoddy product, you're going to be unlikely to buy that, but you also might, you know, blame that brand. So it has an impact on the brand's reputation and a real economic consequence.
Very good. I so appreciate you taking time to come on. I think that, again, this is sort of a different topic for this podcast, but I think that given the timing of going back to school, this is really important information for parents and students alike to hear and understand that, you know, this is a time they're going to spend a lot of money, and this is just great information for them to have to protect themselves. So I really appreciate your time.
Scott, we appreciate the opportunity to share our message with your audience, and wish you success going forward. If you ever need to contact us, you know, folks can also go to our website to get more information. It's c4ip.org, and we'd welcome having folks contact us if they need more information.
Absolutely. And we'll put the link to your website in the text accompanying the podcast. I have to ask before I let you go, do you have a favorite Sonny Bono song?
You know, I actually do. My favorite Sonny Bono song is The Beat Goes On, which is also the name of his autobiography. There's just something about it for me that reminds me of when I was a very young kid. And also just it kind of stands the test of time.
It does. I remember, you know, when there were limited channels on television at a certain point in our lives, Sonny was a fixture on the television in our household. So it's great to hear you talk about that. Well, again, thank you for your time, and thank you to the viewers and listeners for Teaching Matters podcast. I hope that this information is useful as you think about not just back to school activities, but as Frank said, as you have different moments in time throughout the year, whether it's holidays or other things that you're buying for your student, you know, this is something that you should be paying attention to protect yourselves. If you have ideas, thoughts, or suggestions for the podcast, please feel free to reach out to us at teachingmatterspodcast@ohio.edu. That's all lowercase and all one word. We appreciate your time in being one of our audience members, and we hope that you have a great day.